I guess I need to start by saying that not only did I not know what horticulture was when we worked on that farm, I had some pictures of that farm and my mother and me on that farm as a child, but I couldn't get through it, so I took them out. But we also did not know that we were organic farmers. And I did figure out very early, we were organic farmers, and plants looked a whole lot better after you cleaned out a few chicken coops. I tell you, they just look a lot better. Anyway, so I'm going to start the presentation today, and I've divided this into three sections. First section, I'm going to talk a little bit about the current status of ASHS. In the second section, I'll talk a little bit about the ASHX activities this year and what we focused on as the board and as our administrative efforts. And in the last section, I'll talk a little bit about a vision for ASHS in 2050. So for the current status of ASHS, our society is quite healthy and financially sound. I'm not going to go into the details of that because our treasurer and finance committee chair, Joan Davenport, will address that in detail, but I just wanted to ease her into it by saying we're very healthy financially, so no worries. Meeting attendance, I will say that meeting attendance is up over the last few years, and this meeting is the largest attendance meeting in about 20 years, since 1996. Very happy to see that. Our journal subscriptions are also up. As a matter of fact, they're up tremendously high and may be close to at least a 20-year record in journal subscription, the highest ever, even better. So at the same time, our journals, I think the fact that these journal subscriptions are that high proves that our journals are still very desirable and that people all over the world regard us as their journals as the leading source of peer-reviewed horticultural scientific research. I think sometimes we lose track of that inside of that, and we need to focus on that because we are a preeminent place to publish horticultural science results. We also have excellent administrative management, and I'd like to thank all the administration, Mike, Tracy, Cindy, and Nagar, and all the other ASHS staff that's working at the booth. We have most of the staff here today, except for one or two, I think, because we're local and they could all make it. So hopefully everybody has had a chance to meet them and interact with them because they're a wonderful group of people. Through their management, they have basically enabled us to have a very low membership rate and a very low conference registration rate. I'd like to pause in the middle of that thought and say that when we look at our journals here in a few minutes, our journals carry this society. All the income that's disposable and makes it able for the board to make decisions on good projects we want to work on come from the resources of the journals. We have focused for quite a few years on keeping the membership dues low, and we've effectively done that. We've also focused on keeping conference registrations low so that people can get to the conferences. We've been very successful at that. So other people today will show you some more detailed data on this year, but what I'd like to do is go back 30 years and look at membership dues adjusted for inflation, our dues are pretty much on a flat line basis over that 30-year period and actually slightly better value. And that's for the active members. In some other categories, the dues are actually lower today adjusted for inflation than they were 30 years ago. This is in great part due to some tremendously good people who served on the board over the years and an excellent administrative staff that has kept our costs low and focused on the quality of programs for our membership. If we look at our membership dues, if we look at comparing ourselves to other societies in two categories, active dues and conference registration rates, you'll see, I'm looking at the comparison to other plant science related societies, American Society of Plant Biology, Tri-Societies, which is a very large society, agronomically based and soil science based, and phytopathology, another plant. This is another conference that I've attended frequently because a lot of my work has been on host pathogen resistance and interaction. If you look at active membership dues, we're very competitive with societies that are much larger than us. So our membership dues have been maintained. And we look at conference registration. We're the cheapest of the group in terms of the value. So this conference has a tremendously good price-value relationship for our membership. And we want to keep that. So what activities have we focused on this year? And John Dulles spent a considerable amount of time last year talking about Seed Your Future. See, he wrote a column on Seed Your Future, and he did an excellent job last year at his presidential address describing the program. I'm not going to go into detail describing the program. What I want to say is this program was started by SHS members. At the Mary Meyer was president of when it originated, and it was a group of ASHS members, John Doe, Mike, and our administrative director, Mike Neff, Brian Trader. Am I forgetting some other people, the original group there? But anyway, it came out of ideas in ASHS. It's now blossomed into an organization that has its own executive director who I believe is in the room and gave me permission to put her email address. I don't like putting my email address up in public very often. And she also said, put my phone number in there. This lady is very good and has a passion for Seed Your Future and wants to talk to our members who want to take the time to talk to her. The other good news about Seed Your Future is they have a very active web site. This web address is posted here. You go online, you can see all the wonderful programs they have. To reiterate, I think all of us in ASHS should support this program because what they're trying to do is get to our young citizens and basically get them actively involved in horticulture at the upper elementary age when they're still all excited about plants and so forth. And hopefully 15 or 20 years later, we'll have more students in our classrooms. And those who don't have the passion to come on into this in college, a lot of them are going to be good employees for the green industry. And all the predictions are that the green industry is going to have a lot more jobs than can be filled 15 to 20 years down the road. As a matter of fact, they've already got more jobs than they can find people to fill them. So this is an excellent effort to try to plan for increasing interest in horticulture and providing well-trained horticulturalists for the future. I applaud that effort. I have to, without reservation, say I had not a thing to do with it. It was already going. And I just love it. So I'm going to actually get involved in it in my local schools, and I'm going to make sure I use their materials and go talk to some of our students in our community. Something that I have been more involved in is making a better association between ASHS and other societies. We've been an affiliate member for AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, for quite some years. We haven't really done a whole lot of direct activities with them. So I decided to look at what they were doing, how we could interact with them. They have a very wonderful career development collection of modules that cover, there's over 100 of them. They cover things like resume writing, how to prepare for an interview. The one that I like the most is what your advisor didn't tell you about preparing for a job. The students who took these modules also like that one the best. That might tell us a little bit of something about what we're doing as advisors, but hopefully not too much. We were able to procure 200 of these modules free of cost for our students and postdocs to view. We distributed them to students. We got input back from the students. Most of the students really like the modules. So what we're trying to do currently is make sure that we can continue this program. We're going to set up a website we're going to set up our website so that our members may be able to address to access these modules at the same cost that a AAAS member would pay for them, at no extra cost, but they will do it through our webpage. So it's making an association between us. Another area in AAAS is I've been working and trying to develop some symposia at AAAS on topics of horticultural interest. We came close last year in getting one. If any of you in the audience have ideas on things that we could do that we could present to the general science community, I would be like to hear them because I'm going to push for the next few years as I stay involved with AAAS to see if we can get some horticultural symposia in their general meeting. Okay. So the other thing that we did this year is 2 years ago, President Kurt Rahm did a survey of the membership and came up with a lot of suggestions for how we might improve the society, where the strong points are, where the weak points are. Last year, John Doe took the results of that that survey and formed some task forces to look at specifically how we might address some of these issues. Coming out of those task forces, as I came in, we appointed three new administrative committees. These administrative committees are permanent committees in ASHS, and one of them is the Events and Education Planning Committee. This committee will work on trying to improve the quality of this meeting, bring new ideas, new energy to this meeting. There's a Partnership Development and Sponsorship Committee, which is focused on trying to improve industry, our relationships with industry. We have industry members here. If you notice in the previous slide, there's fewer industry members here than there were 30 years ago. That's a little bit telltale of what's going on in society. But I think that for the future, developing stronger relationships with our academic institutions, our federal institutions, and the industry is going to help everybody. So this particular committee is to focus on how we do that, how we make it, this meeting and other other membership things in ASHS valuable to the industry, so they want to come to this meeting and they want to join. And then we also did a Media and Communications Committee, which will focus on how we can improve member benefits by making available to the members a myriad of things ranging from blogs, other communication tools. One idea that I particularly liked was posting slides from extension efforts on different crops, posting some teaching slides so that other members might share those slides and use them in their lectures. We had that program 25 years ago, and I remember when I first taught postgraduate physiology, I got a wonderful set of slides. These were actually slides from Adel Cater in California. And they pulled my bacon out of the fire real quick because I showed up to University of Tennessee, and 3 weeks later, they wanted that class taught. You're a post-harvest guy. You got that in, 3 weeks to put that class together. Those slides saved me the first year. I added to them. And so I think this could be a benefit for any young person coming into the teaching career. Where I focused most of my energy as president was looking at how we might do three things. Digitize our past collections. We put together a plan. We're working with the staff. We've tried to get a count on the total number of articles we have, the total number of pages, and all of our journals all the way back, and in my opinion, the proceedings that go back to 1903. This is a hidden treasure trove of information in horticulture that is literally hidden because nobody looks at paper in the library anymore. So to get these digitized would be a wonderful thing, get them available, not only digitize them, but get DOI numbers assigned to them so they're easier to find, and also then put them into open access. We're working, hoping to not spend any society money doing that. I'm currently working with Mike and the staff. We're going to try to write a grant to get hopefully one of the benevolent organizations out there to support this effort because it opens up all this wonderful agricultural, horticultural literature to the third world countries who've never seen it before and probably aren't going to see it. And also people in our country aren't going to see it anymore if we don't bring it out of the closet. The board did approve assigning DOI numbers to our current journals back to 1990. This helps because when you have the DOI numbers attached, it makes it easier for everybody to at least find the articles and access them. If you click on that DOI number, it'll take you exactly to that article. It's not like a URL where you may or may not be there because the links get broken. This is permanently attached with the metadata to that paper. It won't get lost in the myriad of other things on the internet. We also worked heavily on a plan to take our journals to open access, and I'm pleased to report today that Hort Technology will go full open access effective January the 1st, 2019. The board approved that. The board also approved looking very seriously at taking the journal in Hort Science as fast as possible within 2 to 3 years, watching our budget, to open access as well. We will approach that cautiously because, as I alluded to earlier, we keep membership dues flat under control. We keep meeting costs under control, so the journals are supporting everything in the society. So we're not going to be careless and jeopardize our society, but we think we're going to save parts of that income in the future by getting all these journals to open access. We have data, we've collected data on all three of the journals looking at personal, this is personal subscriptions in blue, institutional subscriptions in orange. And if you look at those over a 5-year period, we've seen a decline in those. And if you drew a projection line, yeah, and I know I have enough statistics classes under my belt to know that you don't predict outside your boundaries. But guess who does that all the time? Warren Buffett. And Warren Buffett knows how to make money. So I sort of follow his model on doing those predictions of how not to lose money. So if we're looking at institutional subscriptions and personal subscriptions going down, that doesn't bode for very well for our income base on the journals being subscription based. And if we actually look at the revenue from those two sources for this particular journal, and this graph is even more drastic in the decline. And that includes 2014, where there was a fairly significant increase in both the individual and institutional subscriptions dollars. So that's a little high. If that increase hadn't been done that year, that point would be significantly lower. And there was also a 5% increase in 2017. So to me, in looking at that after two increases and projecting a few years in the future, and by the way, in 2017, we're only making a few thousand dollars in the black. So if we go the same way and look forward, we're not too long until we're in the red. And since that's our income source, we can't stay in the red. So if we look at this, I think it points to the fact that we made the right decision. Time will tell. Why is this happening? Basically, our librarian at the University of Tennessee has come and talked to most of our faculty about the fact that you guys are taking taxpayer money, doing research, then you're paying to have that research published, and then we're having to buy it back to look at it. So librarians are aggressively, not just our librarian, librarians, many institutional libraries are aggressively looking at trying to go to open access. Now, it's not really that they're totally passionate about open access. Libraries' budgets are decreasing. And as their budgets decrease, they're obviously going to favor open access. But the reality is, as I said in the Reflections article, is it's not 1980 anymore. It's not when I started anymore. We live in a different world, and we have to adjust to it, and open access is the future. We had one of our members, this is a direct quote from their librarian, which I found rather insulting and also humiliating, this person had asked, we currently have an open access option. We pay page charges, but you can get open access for an extra fee, $600. This person was applying to their library for their open access money, which they did have, and they were turned down, and this was the reason. This is a hybrid open access journal, which it is, and the publisher, the American Society of Horticultural Science, does not provide any evidence that it reduces institutional subscription prices based on the number of open access articles published in this journal. So that's a pretty clear statement. We like open access, but this hybrid open access isn't going to buy it for us because you're not lowering our institutional subscription rate because you're putting some open access in. And we can't unless we're open access totally, because if we lower that, then the income goes down and we're heading in the wrong direction again. So there are storm clouds on the horizon. What are we going to do? By the way, that's the Blue Ridge Mountains, about 40 miles from my house. We were up there looking for a mountain laurel and flame azaleas in bloom, and it was raining in the house. And my wife and I hid under a tree and waited until the storm passed. So what do? You wait till the storm passed? We didn't have a choice. But what we want to do is get proactive and say, what can we do to weather this storm? So we went to open access. The benefits of open access, basically, everyone knows what open access is. It stands for unrestricted access to and unrestricted reuse of scientific information published in journals that are open access. The advantages are accelerated discovery. We get our information out there much faster. As soon as the editor-in-chief says this is available, it can go online and you can get it instantly. There can be a DOI number attached to it well before the journal issue numbers and the page numbers are on it. People can get the information. Public enrichment. People who cannot afford to subscribe to our journals, they're not close to a library, and if they are close to a library, many libraries don't subscribe, they can't get it. So we're going to get it to those people. And it's going to improve the educational level. Work technology is a pretty good base starting on this, because this is the journal we perceive as being most applicable to practitioners out in the field, extension agents, teachers. My hope is that the many of the things we publish in teaching in work technology, when it's open access, high school teachers will be able to get to it, and we'll be able to use that information, and it will increase your impact factors. I will make a public open statement that I am not impressed with impact factors. And the person who designed the impact factor system is on record saying he is not impressed for using that for evaluating researchers. What impact factors do, though, is tell you how many times the journal you're publishing in gets cited. So that's valuable information, and it can be used appropriately. But if you look, if your administration or anybody else is interested in increasing the impact factor, it's pretty predictable that it will go up in open access over non-open access. This is a broad-based look at many journals that publish information on ecology. And this was an Ecosphere published by the Ecological Society of America from 2009 to 2013. And they show a clear increase in citations per paper, not the impact factor of the whole journal. Individual papers, your work, your individual work. You get more citations on your individual work in open access. Looking at this a different way, dividing it into high-income countries, low-income countries, developing countries, and mid-level income countries. Across the board in the whole survey, there's an increase in citations and open access. The middle income there is a little confusing. Authors didn't know, but I've reviewed probably at least 150 papers on open access. And like anything else, if you do an analysis, not everybody says it's great. But the overwhelming is about 85% say that it's going to be positive. And 5% say that it's going to be negative, and they're negative people who are finding reasons to make it negative. 10% are some legitimate looks. But the odds are in our favor that we're going to gain from this as a society, and we're going to gain from this greatly as individuals. So the question, the only negative comment I've heard in ASHS is membership for responses to me discussing this in our reflection columns has been, I'm worried, I like open access. I love the concept. I'm worried about how I'm going to pay for it. That's a legitimate concern. I feel your pain. What's happening around us at the same time, though, is that granting agencies, all the federal agencies in the U.S. are favoring open access and recommending open access. A few, NSF, is saying that if you get our funds, you will publish open access, you will make the data available, or we won't give you the funds. And that tends to be the trend of all federal agencies. So if you look at where the money, people are getting money, a lot of it's coming from the federal grant, just putting it in the grant. There are other departments who are setting aside money to publish open access and helping their faculty with. And there are some library funds, just the one we mentioned before, that will help with open access. So there are sources out there. But the bottom line that I've said before is that all administrators who are going to use impact factor to judge their faculty should feel extremely guilty if they don't find a source to help their faculty get funds to publish open access. And in my opinion, the easiest place is to take that overhead we're generating and giving them, and they're taking 40 to 50% of, take a little bit of that and put it in an open access fund in your university to help your faculty get there. I still sympathize with those who can't find a way, but I don't think we have a choice. I think we have to go this direction. Can we weather the storm? That's for John Doe. He's an ornithologist. So. Yes, we can weather the storm. My wife and I stayed in the mountains. It cleared, and we went and saw the kalmia and the mountain laurel and the plain azaleas and had a wonderful day. Got a lot of pictures. Took them out because there's not time. I was going to show you the mountain laurel. Okay, my vision for ASHS. How am I doing? My vision for ASHS in 2050. Why did I choose 2050? Anybody got a guess why we're choosing 2050 as a target? No, really? John, you got a guess, right? All right. Since about 2000, many worldwide organizations, including United Nations, FAO, World Bank, are predicting that the world population in 2050 will hit 9 billion people. Some say, in some of the literature I looked at, say that's an underestimate. It could be 10 to 12. So how are we going to feed those extra people? currently we're feeding the population we have on the globe. We have enough calories to feed people on the on our planet, but there's people going very hungry, and there's people going to bed hungry at night, and there's people starving. That's not due to the fact that we don't have enough food on the planet. It's due to our uneven distribution systems, inequalities in economies, and so forth. So that's something that the world needs to look at. But the fact is, population is going up. Here's the one that I think is the real clincher. This is the average annual increase in percent of the population. So the total population is going up. The percent increase in population is going down. This is based on fertility rate of women in different countries of the world, the number of babies they're having. So if the population is going to go up and the fertility rate is going down and the increase in population is decreasing, what does that tell us? That tells us that those 9 billion people, many of them are going to be older, and many of them are going to be outside their peak productive years. So now we're going to feed more people and we got a less productive population. This is going to cause some worldwide problems. Now let's put the kicker on it. We are talking big about how we're going to help the world and we're going to feed the world in 2050. This is an inflation-adjusted spending on public agricultural research and development of high-income countries, not poor countries, high-income countries. The U.S., if we look from 1960 to 1990, we had about a 4% inflation-adjusted increase in funding to our the things we do. From 1990 to 2010, we only saw it was decreasing. We saw about a 1.3% after inflation. And from 2010 to 2013, and I think that's continuing today, we're seeing negative numbers relative to inflation. More people to feed, less productive population, and less money being put into the research. What role will ASX play in the next 30 years to get us to 2050? That's 32 years away. I think, my personal opinion is this is a wonderful society. I said in the introductory, on the plenary session that I love this society. When I come to these meetings, I get so much energy from the rest of you guys that I'm bouncing off the walls for about the first week or two when I get back to the building. Now, eventually, life catches up with me and that energy diminishes, so I have to have a regular infusion. I almost wish we had meetings twice a year so I could stay a little higher rather than this peak. I'm almost like a manic depressive, you know, when I attend these meetings. But so what roles can ASHS play in our in-grant institutions and our federal institutions for research? We really need to focus on fundamental scientific knowledge, basic knowledge in some of the wonderful techniques in RNA sequencing and so forth that can provide fundamental knowledge that we can use. But if we stop there and we don't take that fundamental knowledge through translational research to practical implications of getting that research to the growers and the community that can use it, we're really wasting a lot of money, and it's not getting where it needs to be. That's my personal opinion. ASHS can play a role in trying to get these communities together. One of the things I'd love to see in the future of ASHS at this meeting is more of the people who left us because they were going more molecular come back to this meeting so they're at the same meeting setting with John Doe and Randy and the rest of you saying, hey, you know, this is a beautiful basic work you're doing. How can we get this out there faster? How can we translate this? And then how can we get that to the extension folks and the people who are actually going to take it to the end consumer? Discovery research for discovery's sake is wonderful. I like it. I mean, I'm a science geek. But my heart in horticulture is let's make that mean something. Let's take that to the level where we're taking that all the way to the consumer. We'd also play a critical role in developing the next generation of horticultural scientists. So those of you who are graduate students in the room, I'll show you something in a second that will either make you a little happy or it's going to scare you pretty bad. So, but we need to prepare you. We need to mentor you and get you there. Outreach, we can play a role in outreach and preparing stakeholders to meet the challenges. So not only we need the basic researchers, we need to bring our growers up to the knowledge of how to use this work that we translate to the level to them. So this is all needed. And we need innovative solutions that integrate fundamental science, technology, and the challenge with the challenges to feed the world in 2050, given climate change, world distribution patterns that are not good. I had a slide in post-harvest that I took out, because the reality is, if you look at the waste in post-harvest between production and retail, even developing companies have huge losses, so does third world. If you look at from retail to the consumer, the industrialized nations are pathetically doing a bad job, and we have all kinds of post-harvest knowledge, but the industry is not adapting it well. We're wasting a lot of food. So there are some numbers that you could calculate that would say we have enough food to feed 9 billion people already, but some of it's going to waste, and a lot of it's being distributed improperly. That's not an area that ASHS or any individual will conquer, but it's one that we all should be aware of, and we should all work. This society should play a role in putting together teams, research teams. So how can we address some of these problems? So I forgot how to point on this. If you look at that arrow coming down, that's about 1974. That's when I joined the society. 1980 is when I became a professional and started working independent of my wonderful mentors, who I had plenty of. And then 2018 is where we are today. Now, if you look at that population sliding from 2018 to 2050, that's 32 years. So for your graduate students, if you don't get ready, I'm pretty sure I'm not going to be there helping you with this. I'll get whatever time I got left, I will passionately try to help anybody who wants to attack these problems with any resources I have. But you're going to be on your own in about 10 or 15 years, I suspect. Although my granddad did live to be 98, so I might make it. I drink too much. I don't eat properly, but he did too, and he lived, made 98. So he's my model. Most of us fall short of our models, right? Okay. So that's basically the vision that I see is my vision. I've described to you, my vision I don't think really counts. It counts to me. Maybe it counts to a few of my friends. But what we need is the graduate students and the young professionals in the early career stage to pick up the vision for this society and to get passionate about it and to drive it to solving these problems so that we feed everybody. And I had a slide in here with my two favorite paintings, which was one was Picasso's Don Quixote. My maternal grandmother taught me to dream. So every time I see that, I think of her. My paternal grandfather, who had me scooping chicken coops, but he also taught me trout fishing, so it was a trade-off. He told me that, son, dream big, but you can dream all you want. If you don't do something to make it happen, it ain't going to amount to diddly. So I saw a painting by Russell, which is a mountain man standing on the edge of a mountain, looking down on an antelope that he had shot. It's a cold blizzard today. It's going to be his dinner. That antelope is about 40 feet down on a straight cliff, and this mountain man is standing there pondering. It's my dinner down there. You know what the title of that painting is? Not meat till it's in the pan. That's my grandfather's message. Had those in, took them out because I thought I was going to run out of time. I may have run out of time. So I want to end on saying thank you to all of you for electing me. Thanks to all of you. I never talked to anybody to try to get them to volunteer for anything. Everybody said yes to a person. I hope that's because you all wanted to. I do tend to be rather persistent and annoying. So maybe some of you might have said that because of that. But I hope you sincerely said yes because you want to help this society. And I say thank you to all the mentors I had over the year. I had personal mentors at the University of Tennessee, at Michigan State, John Bukovac, Jim Frank Dennis, Jim Flory. I had mentors at this society who had nothing to do with me, Adol Cater, Bill Bromwich, Nicholas Faust. I could keep going on forever. People that I met at this meeting who bent over and said, hey, that's interesting. Have you thought about doing this? Some of them even said, hey, that's interesting. I'm doing this. I think I could help you. They didn't have to do that, but they got me started and they got me going. That's what I hope the senior members in this crowd are doing for all the young people in this crowd today. All these pictures on the bottom, they're not just decorative. I've had the privilege of working with all of these things on the bottom and published research papers on every one of them. What that tells me is I'm a plant physiologist, pretty good. I'm a pretty decent biochemist. I'm a semi-decent analytical chemist, but I think I'm a good horticulturalist. And that's where my passion is. So I will willingly accept that title because that's the title I'm on. I'll end with that and say thank you again for the opportunity. Thank you.